as he walks into his city of refuge. Mr. David Bush, and music also from Sarah Groves this morning. Love is still a worthy cause. And good morning to you. About 9.5 minutes after the hour on this Broken Road Radio Monday morning. I'm Jim Park. David Allen Pond is with us. And now joining us from Garden Valley, Texas, Dr. Don Clark. Don is a biochemist, a board member of Creation Moments. And let's see, Don, you should be about, 74 degrees, clear skies. Can you verify that independently for us this morning?
Yes, we woke up and it was a little warmer than I would have liked, but 74 we can live with, but unfortunately it'll probably go to about 92 today.
Ooh, that's too hot. Now, you should consider coming north. Minnesota is a good city of refuge or area of refuge because it's hardly ever warm here, and I think you'd love it.
Oh, well, I've been there in September. In September, we have our face-to-face Creation Moments board meeting and annual discussion. And
oh, that's right. Headquarters in Foley, right?
In Foley, yes.
Yeah,
that's right.
It's up north of the Twin Cities, about 3.5 hours or so, a little bit southwest of what I used to be entertained by a television weathercaster, meteorologist. He always called it Bemidji. He would say the coldest temperature in the nation is in Bemidji, Minnesota this morning. It's Bemidji is what it is.
I think that was the same station that one time was talking about the funeral of a world leader of something, and then she said the station would like to send its condolences.
Well, accidents happen. You know. This was a Phoenix meteorologist, and he probably had not a whole lot of experience with northern Minnesota town names. So I had to be forgiving. So. Dr. Don, we talked about the Big Bang Theory last week, and you know we're predisposed to tackle the whole issue of creation versus evolution and science versus faith in our conversations with you. And in the past, we've talked about radiocarbon dating. And in my mind, at least, you've pretty well given me good reason to think that that's not as reliable as we seem to assume in dating things that are found here on the Earth. But I was reading a portion of my, and Michener's my favorite author, because I love the way he combines real history and real politics with his novel stories and characters. But in his book Space, there's a character who was fundamentally an engineer, a brilliant one, but an engineer, who was one of the first people to be involved in NASA as it was first formed. And he was singled out as particularly possessing this potential to maybe lead the organization. And they sent him for his doctorate to university. And they switched him from engineering and mundane things to celestial mechanics.
Right.
And he just caught fire in the novel. And in particular, one of his studies took him across a photograph of a galaxy. And it was identified with no particular name. It's just known as NGC 4565. And I'm reading this novel. I know it's a novel, but I know it's also thoroughly researched. So I decided, I'll look this up and see if there really is such a galaxy. And lo and behold, there is. And there's a gorgeous photograph of this thing. And he makes much ado about the beauty of this this galaxy in the book. And the picture certainly verifies that. It's a stunning visual sight. But on the Wikipedia page, it says it's 30 to 50 million light years away. And I'm thinking, wait a minute, that means that the light we see reaching us would have taken 30 to 50 million years to get here. If, as Dr. Don claims, the universe is 4,000 years old, how can that be? Unless we were made separately. And then I started to think, well, how do they determine the distance of something that far away? How do they do that, Dr. Don? Do you know?
Well, they look for globular clusters, and the globular clusters have a bunch of galaxies in them, and they may contain millions and millions of stars. Having so many galaxies, and they look for basically kind of the farthest one, and based on the characteristic of the galaxies inside the cluster or the characteristic of the cluster as a whole, they look at the intensity of the light coming from the cluster, and the red shift, as we talked about before.
That would indicate the motion of those bodies in one direction or another.
Perhaps, mm-hmm. perhaps.
Maybe.
It okay. might.
uh-huh.
But it might indicate something else, which we'll talk about. And then looking at the red shift and looking at the intensity of the light, they can say, well, if the red shift is so much using Hubble's data, and of course more refined data now than when Hubble put together his first data back in 1929, as we mm-hmm. talked about last time.
Yeah.
They say, well, okay, it's this globular cluster has to be this far away. And the intensity of light is kind of agreeing with that, because the light intensity decreases by the square of the distance.
Mm-hmm.
They say, well, you know, if it was right here up against us, then it would be this bright. And so this is we can measure the apparent luminescence, if you will, and we can measure, and we can infer then from knowing the distance what the actual luminescence of that body is.
Now, in all fairness, it sounds like a rather crude approximation, but they gave a 30 to 50 million light years is quite a wide span of time or distance. So it sounds to me like they're not really nailing this down, are they?
No,
it's kind
not.
Of a, kind of an now, educated
if you,
guess.
It gets worse if you're talking about the age of the universe, because the age of the universe has been pegged currently at 13.75 plus or minus 0.13 billion years, which one would say, well, gee, that's fairly accurate. How'd they come up with that number?
How did they?
Well, kind of looking for, they do it in a couple of ways, number of ways, actually. The way that I just described, and they say, well, okay, if that's the farthest that we can see, and that's that globular cluster is kind of way out there, and we think that's the oldest, therefore, globular cluster, oldest stars that we can see, we can get at least a bottom number for what the age of the universe is. So they calculate what that number is. Then another way is to use the Hubble expansion rate, and that's a rate that's calculated based on looking at various either globular clusters or light, and doing spectral analysis of light from various stars at various distances, and then calculating a rate of expansion based on that. And then a third way is actually a more modern way, and that's using the cosmic the temperature, basically the temperature using microwave radiation and detection, trying to measure the temperature of the cosmic dust or the cosmic background radiation as far out in space as we can.
You know, and I've got to tell you at this point that in hearing these numbers thrown around in scientific journals, and it's not like I read a lot of them, but you know, over the years I've been exposed to a number of them, my assumption has been this has been mathematically determined. It sounds to me like this is theoretically determined combined with a lot of assumptions.
Well, yes, and an honest cosmologist would definitely say, yes, there are a lot of assumptions, but we think they're good assumptions that go into these calculations. And if we assume that this is true, and one of the major assumptions is that the Big Bang is true. Now, if the Big Bang isn't true, all of these methods fall apart because the cosmic background radiation model is based on the Big Bang, and assuming that, gee, everything was at one point in time, together as a point in space, and that exploded, and so therefore it had to be this temperature in the beginning, which means if so much time has passed, it would be X temperature right now that we can see. So if the Big Bang is incorrect, which we talked about last time, and I believe that it is, then you know what? We don't know what the age of the universe is.
We've got no basis, no way to tell. And you know, I hear this term Big Bang, and I think, well, okay, I can envision a big nothing with a little tiny speck of matter in it where it all started. And then this thing explodes, radiating in all directions out of this central sphere at the same speed. So if that were true, we should be able from our vantage point to maybe somehow determine where the center of that was. And that would be marked by matter moving directly in the opposite direction from us. And we should be able to calculate this stuff. But there seems to be, that just seems to be so far beyond our capabilities technically, that all we can fall back on are theories and assumptions.
Well, that's right. I mean, it's not in the theories are not crazy theories. I mean, if you have certain assumptions like, okay, everything started with a Big Bang, so everything should be moving away from each other. We look out in space, and this is what Hubble did: take the spectral analysis of stars all over the map, if you will, the stellar map. And then plot your numbers in a reasonable fashion based on some assumptions. You come out with, for the most part, a nice straight line that says, gee, the further away from us, it looks like, then the faster a body is moving away. There's all kinds of assumptions in that. Now, Let me pose, because all of this, a lot of the data on the age of the universe is based on a couple assumptions. Well, actually, many assumptions, but the primary assumptions are one, that the speed of light is constant and has been constant throughout history, and that may or may not be the case.
And do we have evidence that it's not the case?
Well, a fellow by the name of Barry Sutherland, I believe it was probably in the 70s, because I was doing a lot of study on creation science at the time, did some basic analysis of the speed of light that had been calculated over the years, and he had data going back like 300 years from the first time that anybody even thought about calculating the speed of light. And when he plotted that, yes, there was a lot of error and a lot of noise, if you will, in the early data, because we can now measure the speed of light quite accurately. You know, back then it was a little cruder in measuring the speed of light.
Yeah, I can't imagine how you do it, frankly. But yeah.
Yeah. So anyway, he saw that the curve was not flat, that it actually, the earlier on, the speed of light increased. Now, if you take the data that he had and extrapolate backwards in time, then you find out that, gee, the speed of light was really fast. If you go back, you know, thousands, not even talking about millions of years, you go back thousands of years, speed of light was could have been really fast. Well, the established scientific community did not hold that data as being credible and tried to poke holes in it and did poke holes in it. And I haven't done recent research on this, but it now appears that, well, perhaps the speed of light was not constant over the history of the universe. If the speed of light was not constant, then what we think is 13.7 billion, you know, light years away may not be that far away.
Because the light was faster at one time, yeah.
The light was faster. Okay, so that's one problem. The other problem, especially using the Hubble expansion constant, is that was the Hubble constant consistent or uniform throughout history. And there's no reason to believe that it was. And so they've made some attempts at assuming different, using different models, mathematical models of how the universe might expand. And then
and contract. I've heard about theories that say it expands and then contracts back to its center and then does it all over again. So
that's one popular theory.
The yo-yo effect, I think.
Yeah, we haven't gotten there, fortunately. So it's not okay. It's not collapsing yet. It's continuing to expand.
That's good news.
But that too is an assumption.
Unless the Mayans had it all figured out, you know, David was talking earlier.
Well, they probably did, and that's why they abandoned their.
They gave it up. Yep.
They gave up. Anyway, that's an interesting story in itself. Anyway, they've tried to make some corrections in the calculation, and are now settling on this 13.75 billion year life. Okay. Now, what if the redshift is not due to a object flying away from us? You know, as was originally thought, the Doppler effect, and every time you hear a train pass, you're listening to the Doppler effect as it's coming, you know, closer to you. Mm-hmm. The sound waves are being compressed, and it sounds like the frequency is higher. And then when it passes, the frequency is what it's supposed to be of a train whistle, for example. And then when it passes you, the sound waves are being stretched out, and reaching your ears is a lower pitch. So. Mm-hmm. It's that principle that was applied to the redshift from the light of these galaxies and stars that Hubble and others have now studied and said, okay, this is the reason why objects are moving away. Now, what if instead of speed, the redshift in these elements, and primarily hydrogen, in the spectral analysis of hydrogen, what if that's due to the thinness of space? That is, the further you go out in space, the thinner it is, and therefore the stretchiness of light in that space, you know, will be.
You mean kind of like the atmosphere gets thinner the farther away from the center of the Earth we get?
Right.
Okay, so the universe, you're saying, what if it were more dense toward the center? Which also implies a shape to the whole thing of some kind.
Right. So what if the space in way deep space is thinner? And so what we're actually looking at is not the movement of these heavenly bodies, but is actually the density, if you will, mm-hmm. and I'm using that term rather loosely, but we understand what that means. Hopefully, density of space is thinner.
The medium, it's the stuff between the heavenly bodies that may be something rather than nothing.
Yeah, exactly. Uh-huh. Well, you know, it's the substance that God spoke in,
mm-hmm. Yeah,
which is space-time. If the space-time is actually thinner way out in space than it is here, then we're not seeing movement at all. What we're seeing is just that, gee, the light has been stretched because of the thinness of space. Mm-hmm. So if that's the case, and I believe that actually is the case, but, you know, I have no way of proving it other than saying, well, you know, the Bible says that the Earth, and therefore the universe, is 6,000 years old. And so now let's tackle then this problem. If a heavenly body is, 200, 800, you know, a billion or 13 billion light years away, mm-hmm. how are we seeing the light from that heavenly body if they're that far away? Now, if space is not uniform, as, a lot of cosmologists will say, well, okay, the space is probably curved, and that could make up, you know, some some of the problem of seeing light that appears to be 13.7 billion light years away, seeing it sooner than that.
Now, help me zero in on that notion a little bit. So that suggests that we're living on the surface of a curve or a shape of some kind rather than in the middle of a spherical universe.
That's right. Okay. Studies have been done that it looks like the universe is a disk and not even a sphere. And that galaxies are clustered around hubs of a disk. So if you looked from the top, if you could, you would see like a target. And the lines of the target would be where the galaxies are clustering. Mm-hmm. And in between, then, the rings and the target is, you know, if it's thin space, so most of the density, if the density of space is around where you see the galaxies, for example, then the space in between could be extremely thin. Now, if the space is thin between these rings, what does that say about the speed of light between the rings? And that would say that, light would go very fast between the rings and would slow down when it hit, you know, one of the rings,
the density,
and then would speed up again. So the distance wouldn't matter that much if light was skipping from ring to ring to ring in a very, very short period of time. And indeed, we could see events that appear to be really far out, really great distances, and in fact, the light is reaching us in a short, relatively short period of time.
I think of traveling on country highways and seeing trying to decide whether or not to pass the car ahead of me. And looking ahead in the oncoming lane, I'm seeing a vehicle at a bird's eye distance, but without seeing the undulations in the road. And it turns out that it's going to take that car a lot longer time to get to my location than I need to pass this car. And so I've been known to take the risk occasionally and make the pass. But you don't know about the dips, and so what we sense as distance with our eyes is really deceiving. And I could see where we're throwing out the speed of light as no longer a constant, and making the density of the universe now anything but uniform, puts us all back to square one, which seems to me to be Genesis.
Right. And so if you have to put your faith in something, and you will put your faith on something, mm-hmm. either you're going to put it on man's knowledge of the universe or God's knowledge.
House of cards here.
Yeah. I vote to put my faith in God's knowledge and God's word. And not that, God says this is how old the universe is, and therefore, you know, thou shalt believe it. Mm-hmm. But he gives us enough hints that if we are interested, we can dig into the Bible and piece some things together and at least know how old man is. And if you believe the first chapter of Genesis, because it all goes back to the first chapter of Genesis, in that man was actually created on the sixth day, along with all of the other with the beast of the field and all the other land animals, then you're left with the conclusion, well, if everything on earth was created within that six-day week, and the stars, the sun and the moon and the stars were created on the fourth day, then everything has to be about the same age, give or take a day, mm-hmm. or two or three.
Mm-hmm. So it seems to me that this whole dichotomy we face between creation and evolution and science versus faith, for the creationist, is a matter of exposing these assumptions, all the scientific foundation, as really not made of concrete block, but made of straw.
Right. Well, and you know, to give credit, you know, to man,
I'm not denigrating the work. But I'm saying that when you stack assumption on assumption on assumption on a theory that may or may not have been proven on another assumption, you get that foundation made of straw.
Right. And you do. And I think that's the one of the job of the creation scientist is to say, hey, wait a minute, what about this? If that's a plausible explanation, is this a plausible explanation as well? Mm-hmm. And if it is a plausible explanation, then we should put our heads together and say, okay, if that assumption is possibly true, then that would imply this, and see if we can find any evidence, you know, for that. So,
and I like the way you put that, because to me, those creationists that stand on their pedestals, point their fingers in the air and say, you're dead wrong. This is the answer. I have it. But would rather...
Those evolutionists.
Those too.
Yeah,
if they would just ask the question, is this plausible? We'd make a lot more progress in this whole dialogue.
Yeah, and I think it would be much more productive. Not that we could ever possibly answer that question,
it's in the searching. It's in the searching that you find the jewels. And I think God encourages us to do that, to ask questions and to wrestle with these issues. And somehow we come back to the Bible and say, aha, it was there all the time.
Right.
That's what I'm finding in life.
Yeah, right, exactly. And it's... God created us to be one creative, and he also created us to be intelligent beings. And with that ability, he obviously said, okay, I'm putting you here in the garden, and you tend it, knowing very well that probably wasn't going to satisfy man's curiosity. Mm-hmm. And I can just imagine God walking in the cool of the evening with Adam and Eve and saying, well, this is how you came about. And, you know, telling him the story, because that would have been one of the first questions that I would have asked, you know, how did mm-hmm. I get here?
Yeah.
You know,
why did you do this? You know, what,
yeah.
And what can I offer you?
Right. And he would have said, well, you know, let's just have a relationship and let's just talk. This is what I kind of wanted, you know. And that's what he wanted from the beginning. And guess what? That's what he wants now. He just wants us to talk to him.
Well, I think it's kind of lonely at the top, you know.
Well, yeah, he's got, I don't know how many angels does he have. But
well, but even they are created beings, you see.
Yeah, they're spirit beings and not spirit and physical beings as we
are. Yeah, so, I mean, it's like you're dealing with kindergartners all the way around. In fact, well, that's another whole topic for us. The thought occurred to me during the sermon at church yesterday that I'm going to have to do some writing and recording about. But it's the notion how God can possibly see us as children, knowing who we are and what we've done in life and the track records we've compiled individually. How can he look at us as pure and innocent? But he did then, and I think he does now. I think he sees what we can be and what we will be, and not necessarily what we are, and proceeds accordingly. So, Dr. Don, this has been a joy again, as always. I've learned something today, and I can't help but feel the creation moments in particular is just a blessing to folks in setting the record straight. And I'd love to be able to amplify the voice of creation moments, and maybe I can do that at least by directing people to the website, which is creationmoments.com. And Dr. Don is a board member there. There are lots of other worthy people. You'll hear the Creation Moments radio program from Ian Taylor several times a day here on Broken Road Radio. And I heartily recommend the visit to the website, because, Don, there are a lot more resources there than just the radio program, aren't there?
Oh, for sure. Yes, we have a 2-minute radio program, and you can actually download that in many different formats. You can listen kind of live, not live, but listen online. You can download it as a podcast, as well as get the written transcripts from our creation moments. And then we also put together booklets of kind of a devotional Bible study of the creation moments with a Bible verse that's called Letting God Create Your Day. And I think we're up to volume 6 of that, which is thousands of of moments, if you will, and thousands of daily Bible studies
and videos, DVDs.
Right, we have put several of the of our more popular creation moments into a video format.
Okay. Well, it's a terrific resource, and I want to suggest that you visit them, creationmoments.com. You can link to them from our website. Maybe you're listening on brokenroadradio.com this morning. If you're on Live 365, come on over to the website and link directly to Creation Moments and explore that site. I think you'll learn a lot, and I think it'll make your day. So, as Dr. Don makes ours just about every Monday during our 8 o'clock hour here in the Central Time Zone. And Don, once again, thank you for enlightening us, and we'll look forward to next Monday.
Oh, well, thank you very much, and it's been a pleasure being a part of your show.
Well, be blessed today. Dave, I didn't let Dave into the discussion. I'm sorry,
well,
Dave.
Well, hi, how are you?
I've been noticed been listening and smiling and nodding his head. I'm just wondering if he's had a thought during this
conversation. I have had many thoughts, and I don't know how many times over in my life I've listened to, you know, some new explanation of the speed of light or the way that the universe looks or the, you know, and all those, and this is, you know, that the universe looks like more like a disc than an expanding ball. That's an interesting idea too, because I've seen that image.
Be Dr. Don's Frisbee theory of the universe.
Yeah, the Frisbee theory. Yeah, exactly. And you know, and I mean, I think we should start listing the new theories that we've got. We've got the devolution theory. Yep. And the Frisbee theory. I think we should start putting those on so we can establish a baseline so that when these things are finally discovered by the rest of the world, we can come back and say, see, look, see, we said it first.
Great big gotcha. Yeah.
It is perhaps a testament to my 40 years of indoctrination of the public school system that I mentally challenge all this information, and then as soon as I think about it a little bit, I say, "Wait a minute, that makes as much sense as what I've been buying into."
Yeah,
and that's the interesting. That's the constant interesting thing for me is that, you know, like the devolution theory, like the Frisbee theory, like the bending of speed of light, and also that the speed of light is not constant. Who knew?
Well, it was. I'll tell you, it was created by a mastermind, and we can't help but figure it out. Yeah.
Yeah. you're expanding my mind, just like the universe. I mean, it's just continues to be an interesting subject. Please keep coming back.
Don, thanks again. Well, be blessed today.
For sure, it is. Yeah. Okay.
And we'll talk to you.
Bless you, folks.
All right. See you, Don.
Dr. Don Clark from creationmoments.com. Recommend a visit to that website. Music continues now on a Broken Road Radio Monday. Los Lonely Boys.